Okay, before religion in Hollywood came to mean Scientology instead of Cecil B. DeMille movies, before The Golden Compass had its script gutted by New Line Cinema, before remakes and sequels took over from originality, and way before the stars of horror movies stopped being the actors and became the directors, there was paleo cinema. Hi and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 7. My name is Terry Frost and I'll be your content provider for today. In this podcast, I'm going to do some other stuff. I've said before that I'm going to do new things, but this time I sort of mean it. Okay, I'm going to start off with my own list of the Magnificent Seven action stars before 1980. I'll look at the first of my guilty pleasure movies, and I'll start looking at lesser-known film noir. Christmas here was pretty hot. We got up to about 42, 43 degrees centigrade, which is around 107 American. There's not a lot you can do when it gets above 40 except sit indoors with the air conditioning on, drink really good beer, and watch DVDs, which is pretty much what I did when I wasn't at work. So let's get into it. By the way, I'd like to thank Weaverman and Serps for the feedback. You guys are keeping me going, and I do appreciate it, and so does Sally. She appreciated the feedback on her contributions to the last podcast. The Magnificent Seven is one of those really seminal bloke films, even more than The Seven Samurai, upon which it was based. This film is one that every guy should have in his DVD collection. There are a few other films you should have in your DVD collection as well. Robin Hardy's version of The Wicker Man, the original Thomas Crown Affair, and Sam Peckinpah's Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. As my fellow Australian Clive James has said, every movie buff should know the names of the actors who played the Magnificent Seven, and for bonus points, which one saved Frank Sinatra from drowning. Now I'm going to do this off the top of my head without referring to notes, okay? Magnificent Seven. Steve McQueen, Yul Brynner, Charles Bronson, James Coburn, Brad Dexter, Horst Buchholz, Robert Vaughn. There you go. And by the way, it was Brad Dexter who once saved Sinatra from drowning in Hawaii. There are only two people who starred in The Magnificent Seven who are still alive. There's Robert Vaughn, who's doing Hustle in the UK at the moment, and Eli Wallach, who played Calvera, the bandit leader. All the rest of them have stepped on the rainbow. In a whimsical moment a few days ago, I decided to make my own Magnificent Seven of action film stars who were doing the gig before the 1980s. The rules are pretty simple. First off, they can't be any one of the original Magnificent Seven. Secondly, even though it's tempting, people like Arnie, Sly, Bruce and Chuck Norris are out of contention. The actors I pick have to have been acting when the Magnificent Seven was made. Thirdly, the list is open for discussion. If you want to put in your contribution, cultguru with a K at gmail.com. The other criterion I put in there, just for totally personal reasons, was that John Wayne is out of it because he's too obvious a choice and I don't much like him, even though my mum has more of his movies than any three people I know. She's got this thing for John Wayne that's totally inexplicable, but there you go. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about the first of my seven, and that's Burt Lancaster. Give you a bit of a bio on him. He was born Burton Stephen Lancaster in New York City on November 2nd, 1913. He started his career as a circus acrobat until an injury ended that gig. Now, he didn't make a movie until he was 33 years old, which these days is not really on, but it wasn't all that common in those days either. He was in The Killers, the movie based on the Hemingway story, and unlike a lot of movie stars, he was tall. He was somewhere between 6'2 and 6'3. He had an engaging, cheeky grin. Best one in Hollywood at the time. He had teeth that looked like brand new Mahjong tiles. Lancaster established himself in movies like Desert Fury, I Walk Alone and Sorry Wrong Number before going back to his acrobat roots and making The Flame and the Arrow and The Crimson Pirate wear with his old mate Nick Cravat, with whom he did the circus act. He swashbuckled and showed us that for him, gravity wasn't really as arbitrary as it was for the rest of us. But Lancaster was never just charismatic beefcake, and from here to eternity he was a great romantic lead as well as a man of action. In Come Back Little Sheba, he was the emotionally distant, recovering alcoholic Doc Delaney. He went from playing Wyatt Earp in Gunfight at the OK Corral straight into the monstrous, poison-tongued journalist and broadcaster J.J. Hunsinker in Sweet Smell of Success.
Mr. Falco, whom I did not invite to sit at this table tonight, is a hungry press agent and fully up to all the tricks of his very slimy trade. Match me, Sydney.
In 1960, he got the Best Actor Oscar for the title role in Elmer Gantry. And he was a great actor, serious actor in the 60s in films like 7 Days in May, Judgment at Nuremberg, Visconti's The Leopard, and one of the great unsung films of that decade, The Swimmer. On a personal level, he was very much in for social change. He was a great critic of the Vietnam War and the McCarthy witch hunts. And in the 80s, he supported AIDS charities. Now, remembering Lancaster in action roles, I recall some really great moments of film. In Gunfight at the OK Corral during the battle itself, he does a dive and roll that always thrills me. It's an enormous dive roll, get behind cover, shoot at somebody. Haven't seen anything like it in any other film. In The Professionals, there's that really cool scene where he runs his finger over a stick of sweating dynamite, then snaps the droplet against the wall of a shed where it makes a loud cracking sound. Now, he stunts with Nick Cravat in The Flame in the Arrow and The Crimson Pirate are filled with a kind of joyous, irrepressible dynamism. And in other action films I like of his, His Majesty O'Keefe, where he plays a trader on the island of Yap, and The Hallelujah Trail, Apache and Trapeze. He's just got this energy that blazes off the screen. No guy in movies moved as beautifully as Burt Lancaster did. Maybe Hollywood should start casting retired acrobats again. It worked with Burt Lancaster. It also worked with Jackie Chan and his mate Sammo Hung, who got their start as child acrobats in Beijing Opera. Now, I'll give you a few sound samples from Burt Lancaster just to give you a taste of what the man was like. The first two are from my favourite Burt Lancaster film of all time, which is not an action film. It's the one I mentioned a little moment ago, The Swimmer, where he plays a guy called Ned Merrill who decides he's going to swim across Westchester County from where he is to his home by swimming through all of the swimming pools of his neighbours. As he travels along his way, we learn more and more about him. I won't spoil the movie, but if you get a chance to watch it, please do. It's one of those great unsung movies of the 1960s. It's weird and very touching in a lot of ways. So here's the first sound sample where he appears in his swimming trunks at an acquaintance's pool, and they haven't seen him for a while, so they get into a discussion with him.
Where have you been keeping yourself?
Oh, here and there, here and there.
So, it's not because our service is bad, huh?
What a day. You ever see such a glorious day?
The next bit is where he decides he's going to swim across the county to his home.
I could do it. I could really do it.
Do what, Nettie?
Well, now at the Grahams, there's a string of pools that curves clear across the county to our house. Well, look, the Grahams, the Lears, the Bunkers, then over the ridge, then a portage with the Paston's riding ring to the Hallorans and the Gilmartins, then down Alewise Lane to the Biswangers, and then... Wait a minute, who's next? I can't think. I had it just a minute ago. Who is it? Well, who is it? Who's next to the Biswangers?
Shirley Abbott.
Shirley Abbott. Then across Route 424 to the Recreation Center Pool, then up the hill and I'm home. Well, don't you see? I just figured it out. If I take a sort of a dog leg to the southwest, I can swim home.
The last soundbite I'm going to do is just the bit at the start of The Crimson Pirate showing him as Captain Vallo, the captain of the Crimson Pirate, and it just gives you a little bit of an idea of the feel of that film.
In a pirate ship, in pirate waters, in a pirate world, ask no questions. Believe only what you see. No, believe half of what you see.
Here's what David Thompson in his new biographical dictionary of film has to say about Burt Lancaster. Well into his 60s, he was still a strapping athlete, his smile piercing, his hand outstretched, but with the hint that his grip could crush or galvanize. His vitality was more than cheerfulness or strength. He seemed charged with power. This accounts for his threatening polite calm as a villain and coincides with Norman Mailer's comment that he never looked into eyes as chilling as Lancaster's. I'll be doing the next of my Magnificent Seven action film stars next podcast. But now let's move on.
Cannibal! Cannibal coming.
Guilty pleasures. Everybody's got them in cinema. Everybody has films that their friends and their family and any objective criterion of excellence says are total crap, but they still have an inexplicable fondness for them. Sometimes it's a movie you saw when you were a child. Sometimes it's a movie you saw when drunk or stoned or ripped in some way. Maybe it's the first movie you saw with someone you love. But one way or the other, we have these guilty pleasures which are hard to explain to people. So I'm going to go into a few of mine and try to do that explanation in spite of the perils of attempting it. So here's my first one. I love guilty pleasures mainly because I really feel guilty about them. I'm not much of a Puritan, but there are movies I like which, by a lot of objective criteria, are total hydrogen sulfide. Everyone has their own software malfunction when it comes to movies we love, and I'm going to talk about one of mine this podcast, and I'll make it a series, and I'll talk about future guilty pleasures in future podcasts. Now, my first guilty pleasure is Alice in Wonderland. Not the 1951 Disney version, nor the versions done in 1999, 1915, 1931, 1986, 1955, or 1998. I'm talking about the 1976 pornographic musical version of Alice in Wonderland, directed by Bud Townsend and starring Christine DeBelle. Now, the 70s was an interesting era in porn movie. It was kind of a golden age of porn. Before videotape turned the industry into a silicon-enhanced factory for orgasms where pubic hair was as rare as a good script, there were people making these films who had the mad but interesting conceit that they could make erotic flicks that were entertaining, amusing and witty, as well as titillating. Bill Oskow and Howard Zeem's Flesh Gordon, made in 1972, combined nostalgia for the Flash Gordon movie serials of 30-odd years before with some rather juvenile porn and comedy. They had terrific model work in them, some stop-motion animation of a high quality, and pretty high production values for the budgets. Radley Metzger's 1976 The Opening of Misty Beethoven was a witty, intelligent, and funny porno version of Pygmalion, or My Fair Lady, which, oddly enough, created its own remake in Misty Beethoven the Musical in 2004. So, in the 70s, porn had some aspirations to quality, and Alice in Wonderland was a part of that belle époque. As with Flesh Gordon, the producer in this one was Bill Oskow, so it pretty much came out of the same stable as Flesh Gordon. In this iteration of the Lewis Carroll story, Alice is a virginal librarian who's shy and scared of her own sexuality. She follows a white rabbit down the rabbit hole and meets the usual suspects, the Mad Hatter, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, Humpty Dumpty, the Red Queen, but they're not as we remember them from the kiddie movies. Now, I'll just do a little bit of a clip for you. This is one of the songs from Alice in Wonderland, just to give you a little feel of this particular movie.
You are a ruffian. What's a nice girl like you doing on a night like this? On a thing like that? Should have been careful where you sat. Why don't you settle down, get married, raise a family? In a house with a white picket fence filled with kids and a little
puppy. What a nice girl like you doing on a night like this? This cigar, let's see.
Golly gee.
Get up right now and change your ways. You can't have your cake and eat it too.
That was a nice girl like you, I suppose. As you can hear from that, it's kind of whimsical, and it's got quite a lush musical score for a porn movie. Though the sound mixing is a little bit rough. That may be partly because the version I've got looks like it's a VHS video rip. So obviously the sound quality is not that great. Now, the music is kind of whimsical and humorous in a burlesque joke kind of way. In fact, a lot of the jokes in it have had a few birthdays before the movie came out. But it counts as paleo cinema for one very good reason. It's part of a genre that has changed enormously since this film was made. Porn films are nothing like this film now. They're a lot more utilitarian and a lot less artistic than a lot of the films from the 70s. They've lost something, and I kind of feel sorry for kids growing up, and as kids do, you know, teenagers and young men mostly, as they do, they tend to watch porn, but the kind of porn they're getting is low-quality crap with, it's got more plastic surgery in it than most of the disfigured veterans from World War II ever got. That's my first choice for a guilty pleasure. Alice in Wonderland, I think it's available around the place. You may want to get it, you may know it. But that's the first of mine, and I'll do another guilty pleasure next podcast in 3 weeks' time. I'll just give you another little sound thing from Alice in Wonderland just to indulge myself. Here it is.
Who are you?
I'm me, and that's he.
Where are we?
You see?
Not exactly. Don't you have names?
Certainly. I'm a Boogaloo.
I'm a Oogaloo.
I'm a Maggie.
And I'm a Scrub.
What's silly name?
What's yours?
I'm Alice. What's so funny?
We think your name is silly, too.
What are you doing here, Alice?
I'm trying to find the rabbit. Have you seen him?
No. But those are his woods.
I'm so confused. I don't know what I'm doing here. One minute I'm in a real world, and the next thing I know, I'm here in a make-believe one.
Alice, what makes you think your world is real and ours is imaginary? Maybe it's the other way around.
Okay, film noir. Yeah, no, we're talking about film noir. We're talking black and white. We're talking about deep shadows. We're talking about trench coats and retractive women. Now, movie buffs love film noir. They've got the impressionistic black and white cinematography, femmes fatale, hard cops with soft hearts, cruel fate and corruption, stylized dialogue. How can you not love it? Now, the movie I'm going to talk about is one of the kind of second range films noir, The Big Combo. It's written by Philip Yordan and directed by Joseph H. Lewis in 1955. And this is distilled film noir. It's kind of taken down to an essence. It stars Cornel Wilde playing Lieutenant Leonard Diamond, a cop who's obsessed with Mr. Brown, played by Richard Conte, the sociopathic head of the Combination, a big crime gang. Now, Leonard's obsessed with Mr. Brown partly because he's in love with Brown's girlfriend, Susan, played by Jean Wallace. When Susan overdoses on pills in an upmarket nightclub, she mentions a woman's name while in a coma, Alicia. Diamond follows through on this and tries to find out who Alicia is. And as the movie develops, Brown becomes as obsessed with Diamond as the cop is with him. Joe McClure, played by Brian Don Levy, the guy who later played Quatermass in a couple of the Quatermass movies in England, is planning to overthrow Brown. So there are a few other characters in there as well. Susan's bodyguards are called Fante and Mingo, played by Lee Van Cleef and Earl Holliman. And there's a really strong implication that they're a gay couple, which is kind of unusual for a film in the 1950s. Fante and Mingo kidnap Diamond, and Brown tortures him to try to find out what he knows about Alicia. And one of the things he does while torturing him is using McClure's hearing aid as a sonic weapon. He jams it in Diamond's ear and plays really loud music into it to try to deafen him. So that's quite an unusual way of torturing people. A little bit different from rubber hoses and batons and things like that. The cinematography in this film is by a guy called John Alston, and it's terrific. It's got deep shadows and pools of light and lots of lighting from below up towards the characters. But it's always to really good effect, and it's not ever gratuitously done. And one of the other things I like about this film is about 90% of it takes place at night. It's like daylight doesn't exist for most of the characters in the story. Now, while it's good and intense as Diamond, his character's kind of a close cousin to Dana Andrews, cop in Laura.
A new all-night bar opens with gambling outside city limits. A bunch of high school kids come in for a good time. They get loaded, they get irresponsible. They lose their shirts, and they get a gun. Because they're worried, they want to make up their losses. And the filling station attendant is dead with a bullet in his liver.
It's got the same kind of hard-boiled intensity. Richard Conte is very good as Mr. Brown. He's as hard as stone. He's holding on to control with a mouthful of self-serving aphorisms. And the ability to psychologically dominate everyone around him. He's got a little bit of that feel of Sir Ben Kingsley's character in Sexy Beast. He's just got that kind of intensity that dominates.
How do you feel now, Benny?
Lost. I feel terrible, Mr. Brown.
You kept fighting, Benny. You've got heart.
Lost three of my teeth, too.
All right, so you lost. Next time you'll win. I'll show you how. Take a look at Joe McClure here. He used to be my boss. Now I'm his. What's the difference between me and him? We breathe the same air, sleep in the same hotel. He used to own it. Now it belongs to me. We eat the same steaks, drink the same bourbon. Look, same manicure, same cufflinks. But there's only one difference. We don't get the same girls. Why? Because women know the difference. They got instinct. First is first and second is nobody.
The best man won a night, Mr. Brown.
You were better than Martinez. Only you threw it away. You step in the ring and shake hands with him. You want to be his friend and you want to fight him. No, Benny, no.
Mr. Brown, shut the door.
Now, Benny, who runs the world? Have you any idea?
Not me, Mr. Brown.
That's right, not you. But a funny thing. They're not so much different from you. But they've got something. They've got it and they use it. I've got it. He hasn't. So what is it, Benny? What makes the difference? Hate. Hate is the word, Benny. Hate the man who tries to beat you. Kill him, Benny, kill him. Hate him till you see red and you'll come out winning the big money. And the girls will come tumbling after. You'll have to shut off your phone and lock the door to get a night's rest. Get on your feet, Benny.
What'd you do that for, Mr. Brown?
You should have hit me back. You haven't got the hate. Tear up Benny's contract. He's not good to me anymore.
Now, this film's not one of the best films in the world, but it is a very strong film noir. Brian Donlevy's death scene is one of the great moments in this particular genre. I'm not going to spoil that, but do see it, and you'll know what I mean. The big climax where Diamond confronts Brown in a fog-shrouded airport hangar is almost as good as Brian Donlevy's death scene. It's minimal sets, lots of fog, lots of strong lighting. And it works. To get a really good dramatic climax, you don't need to have massive explosions, cars tumbling over each other like Lego bricks, and people leaping out of the way of crashing 747s. You can do it with a very minimalist set, low budget, and still have it come out very good. Now, Philip Yordan, the screenwriter who wrote The Big Combo, isn't one of the biggest names in the business. But in the same year as The Big Combo, he also wrote The Anthony Mann Western, The Man from Laramie, starring James Stewart. I just happened to have seen this a few weeks ago, and it's a very good Western. I've been watching a few Westerns lately. I may talk about them in a future podcast, but I'm kind of going back and watching a couple of the Bud Boudica, Randolph Scott Westerns as well, so I really should talk about them at some stage. Now, among the other things Philip Yordan wrote the screenplays for, I think he went over to England and did a lot of epic films towards the end of the big epic film cycle. He scripted The King of Kings, El Cid, oddly enough, The Day of the Triffids, 55 Days at Peking, Fall of the Roman Empire and The Battle of the Bulge. So, you know, he's got some chops there. And the dialogue, which I'll play little snippets of the dialogue somewhere in here, and you'll see what I mean about it being very abstract and very kind of condensed film noir. I like it a lot. I don't think you could get away with it now. I think movies like Sin City tried it, and I'm sure that one of the influences on Quentin Tarantino's dialogue has been films like this, where the talk is very stylized, but it's intelligent, sharp, witty, and it conveys character at a very high bandwidth. Now, the jazz score to the film is by one of my favorite film composers, David Raxon. Any film with a Raxon score is enhanced by it. He's the guy who did the Laura, the Bad and the Beautiful, whole bunch of other things. And another one of the smaller ones I like of his is a film called Sylvia, made in 1965, starring Carol Baker. It's a better score than the movie is. There are times when Raxon, in his later career, did movies that weren't as good as his music. Now, the disc I've got of The Big Combo is very cheap at Amazon. You really should pick it up. It's only a few bucks. There are no extras on the disc, but with a little judicious Googling, you can get all the extra information you need about this one. Check it out. Let me know what you think. For the next podcast, I'll be looking at another lesser-known film noir, Otto Preminger's Angel Face, starring Robert Mitchum and Gene Simmons. We'll leave that one for next time, and I'll give you a few sound bites from The Big Combo.
Hello, Lieutenant. This is Mr. Brown.
What do you want, Mr. Brown?
Joe, tell the man I want her out.
Mr. Brown would like to have Miss Lowell released. He'll put her in a private hospital.
Is your relative?
Not exactly.
Married to her?
Just a personal friend.
Yeah, visiting days are Tuesdays and Fridays. I don't know how you two got in here. You can get out the way you
tell
came.
Tell the man not to get excited.
Mr. Brown is a very reasonable man. You don't know him.
Oh, is he? Well, I'm not. And I intend to make life very difficult for your Mr. Brown.
You shouldn't talk like that, Lieutenant. You're overstepping your authority.
Joe, the man has reason to hate me. His salary is $96.50 a week. The busboys in my hotel make better money than that. Don't you see, Joe? He's a righteous man. Personal feelings mean nothing to him. My girl's dying in a public hospital, and I want her out.
She's under arrest, Mr. Brown.
What's the charge?
Homicide.
It's ridiculous. She wouldn't kill a fly.
She tried to kill herself.
Is that a crime?
It happens to be against two laws, God's and man's. I'm booking her under the second.
Okay, now on to a few other things. I recently got a ton of stuff from Amazon.com. I'll be talking about some of it in the podcast, but one of the things I've decided to do this year based on that sudden influx of DVDs is to make a list of all the movies I watched in 2008. I've got a book sitting on top of the TV set that I use for this particular purpose now. Now, as I talk, it's now the 13th, Sunday the 13th of January 2008, and I think I've done about 18 movies already this year, more than one a day. I'll just go through them, list them, and maybe talk a little bit about them, but not too much. First one I saw was Special Mission Lady Chaplin, which is a 1960s Eurospy movie. Low budget, but it stars Daniela Bianchi, the Bond girl from Russia with Love. And it's not too bad. It's low budget, but in spite of that budget, it's got a lot of European locations. The guy playing the hero looks like a retired football player, but I'll put a link to the IMDb page on the website about that, so you can take a look for yourself. I also saw Blood of the Vampire, an early, I'm not sure whether it's Hammer or not, but an early Hammer-type movie starring Sir Donald Wolford. I saw The Hellfire Club starring Keith Michelle. The Mac, a very good blaxploitation film starring Max Julian. It's about basically a guy who gets out of jail and becomes a pimp. And it was filmed on the streets of Oakland in California with the cooperation of the Black Panthers. So there's a lot of extra material on the DVD about how their relationships went with the Black Panthers while they were filming it, and also how their relations went with some of the pimps who were secondary actors in the movies. They had some real-life Oakland, California, 1970s pimps in this film. I saw the recent Russian film Day Watch, the sequel to Night Watch, and that was a lot of fun too. Lots of great action sequences, some good magic stuff. If you haven't seen Night Watch and Day Watch, in spite of the fact that it's not paleo cinema, check them out. Good stuff. You've got to get your head around the kind of Russian headspace a little bit when you watch them, but definitely recommended. I saw a very bad 1960s Italian black and white vampire movie called The Playgirls and the Vampire, where a whole bunch of showgirls and their manager end up in a spooky castle where there are vampires. Not much to recommend in that one. I saw Seven Men from Now, the Bud Bodica western starring Randolph Scott. As I said about The Big Combo being a distilled film noir, Seven Men from Now is an incredibly distilled western. It's taken down to the essence of westerns. And if you haven't seen any of those ones, check it out. I also saw Wild Zero, weird Japanese flying saucer rock and roll vampire, flying saucer rock and roll zombie movie. Low budget, but it's got a certain kick-ass energy to it. I rewatched Kill Bill Volume 1. I'm going to watch Volume 2 tonight. But I wanted to kind of revisit it after a few years just to see what I thought about it now. I still like it. I still think Tarantino's got a lot of talent, and he's got that gift of blending genres and borrowing from the past without it seeming like it's been stolen. I've got a lot of respect for the guy, and I do like his stuff. I saw Death Proof, and I like that too, even though it has copped a lot of criticism for various sources. Having seen the original Grindhouse-type movies, I do appreciate what he was trying to do and what he actually achieved in Death Proof. What did I see? Frightmare, the Peter Walker English shock horror movie. I think it was shocking in the 1970s, but I found it a little dull at places. It's about a family who's harbouring a cannibal in their midst. I also saw Friday. I saw X the Unknown, the 1960s Hammer film starring Dean Jagger as a scientist. It's kind of like a pre-Quatermass type film. Quite fun. One of the nice bits is watching actors like Anthony Newley get swallowed up by radioactive sludge. I also saw a very early Hammer film, The Four-Sided Triangle, starring Barbara Payton and James Hayter. It's about, it's a kind of weird thing. It's a combination. It's almost in some ways like a bucolic Michael Powell film crossed with a science fiction movie. It's basically the plot line is that two childhood friends get together when they grow up and they're both in love with the same girl and they create a matter duplicating machine and duplicate the girl. But unfortunately, she stays in love with the guy she was originally in love with. Interesting film from a paleo cinema viewpoint. I may talk about it more later, but I'm going to rewatch it and just see what I think of it on a second viewing. Sort of very bad. Sally's got this, not obsession, but she's got this interest in really bad, low-budget, modern horror films with really crappy CGI, you know, they're usually monster movies. Saw a really bad one of those called Razortooth, which was a giant mutated eel in the bayou. And lots of people getting chewed in half by giant eels and all sorts of weird and wonderful things. Saturday, I watched Alice in Wonderland and the Big Combo. I also saw She, the 1936 version of the H. Rider Haggard story, starring Randolph Scott and Helen Gahagan, who later on ran for president of the United States in the 1940s. And the most recent film I've watched is a musical, It's Always Fair Weather, directed by Gene Kelly and Stanley Donen. I'm going to talk about that in a future podcast when I'm going to be discussing movies that are musicals, but not the mainstream ones. I'm going to talk about like second rank musicals that are better than a lot of the big famous ones. And It's Always Fair Weather is definitely one of those. It's a very cynical musical in some ways. It's kind of got a little bit of the feel of Pal Joey about it. It's about three soldiers who, when they come back from World War II, decide to meet up 10 years later. And during those 10 years, their lives haven't gone the way they want them to. Very good film, very good musical. It's got a great sequence of Gene Kelly dancing on roller skates before Xanadu. That's about it. They're all the films that I've seen so far. I've also got a lot of other DVDs from that sudden burst of buying from Amazon. I did finally pick up a copy of John Boorman's Point Blank starring Lee Marvin. I'll talk about that next time around. I picked up SOB, the Blake Edwards film, most famous for being the movie where Julie Andrews shows her breasts. Superfly, the 1970s blaxploitation film starring Ron Neal. Things I picked up the box set of the first season of one of the best TV westerns, Have Gun Will Travel. Second episode I've watched so far, and the guest star in the second episode is Charles Bronson. So I found that quite interesting to enjoy. They're half an hour episodes, so you can kind of nibble at them and get through the series in fairly good time. And I've got a few other things. Bad Day at BlackRock, the John Sturges film starring Spencer Tracy, Robert Ryan, Lee Marvin and Ernest Borgnine. I've got that to enjoy in a high-quality widescreen print, so definitely looking forward to that. Let me think. I'm just going through this mental pile of DVDs I have. I've got Deadlier Than the Male, another 60s Euro spy exploitation movie starring Richard Johnson. Unfortunately, the DVD quality is very low on that one, so if you do see it available as a standalone, there is a box set of the two Bulldog Drummond movies that Richard Johnson did in the 60s. I'm not sure about the quality of those, but the quality of this one was a little bit dodgy, so I'm a little bit disappointed in that. I've also got Raw Meat, the 1970s horror film, also known as Deathline, about cannibals living in the London Underground. I'm going to savour that and enjoy it later this week at some stage. I also picked up a few movie books, but I'm saving talking about those until I do a podcast about movie reference books that we all should have. Anyway, that's about it for this podcast. Please give your feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. We'll be posting some reviews on the website as well. There are a lot of things that I can't cram into a podcast, but I can definitely write about, so I will be doing that. And that's it for now. I hope you guys are enjoying your new year so far and continue to do so. And I'll be back in about 3 weeks. Catch you then.